Meeting on Business Transportation and Workforce Development for Thursday, our last, next to last Senate day, for Senate bills, I mean. And we have, as you see, a very packed agenda with a lot of stuff. So I want to try to get moving as fast as we can. Some of our issues here will be, are still going to be continued to work on as we move them through the process. But this will at least get that going. Let's get rid of our old issues here first. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 965. Janet, let's do that first, the high-cost home loans, and tell us kind of where the committee, where we are. We have a new amendment, correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last time we had the 965-2s, which applied to mortgage bankers and consumer finance lenders but exempted banks and credit unions, and it required a number of specific things and prohibited a number of specific things lending. It did prohibit negative amortization except for reverse mortgages and jumbo loans. It did prohibit prepayment penalties after the first year. It did prohibit loan flipping unless it has a tangible net benefit to the borrower, and prohibited loan provisions that allowed discretion to accelerate required payments. Banks and credit unions were exempt from 965-2. The 965-3s, which are now the 965-5s, and they should be at your place today. The changes in this, in 965-5, these are the guidelines that are established by the National Conference of State Bank Supervisors and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. These are the guidelines put in as standards into Oregon law, and they do have a penalty sections at the end, or enforcement sections at the end of the bill. And the new section is section 14, which gives the agency the investigation ability and the ability to order cease and desist orders, which was missing from the original bill, the original amendments. The original amendments would have required the agency to go to court. And it's important to note that the -5 amendments, as the previous version of those amendments, just apply to non-traditional mortgage products, and that is defined in the bill. The only other change in the -5 was to take out a couple of phrases in the bill that were inflammatory, the words predatory lending and the word a troubling increase in irresponsible lending. So those were taken out of the findings section at the request of some of the lenders. There is a enforcement section. There was a bit of discussion after the meeting as to whether, instead of creating a new enforcement section, a new penalty section, whether that could be put into each of the institution's specific sections of law. And there was difficulty doing that because of some questions about equal protection under a constitutional problem. And so that was not proceeded with last night. So, Mr. Chair, the penalty section is the same as in the -4s, again, with the addition of the cease and desist section. And there is still a private right of action in the -5s.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. And again, appreciate everybody's work on this. Committee, we have a disagreement at the moment between the -2s and more now the -5s from the different lenders preferring a different route. I'm open to either the 2 or the 5 at this point. Keep in mind we're going to continue to work on this. There are some other issues that we have talked about that I think we can resolve as we move this thing through the House side. But I think I'd ask, Mr. Martinez, would you come forward? And then, like I was saying, I think you represent the -2 preference. And who would like to represent the -5 preference? Is there somebody that would like to do that? Just so we can, the committee can hear that as we deliberate on which direction we want to move with this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While they're coming up, I'd like to enter into the record a letter from our Oregon in support of the -2s that was received today, and it's at your place.
Okay. Yes. They prefer the -2s. So let's, gentlemen, let's kind of keep our remarks now through the differences between the two, and so the committee can decide which one we want to continue to advance.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. We're in support of the Dash Fives, although we believe there's some significant work that needs to be done in the Dash Fives. And I would just highlight for you the solution that all of us talked about yesterday after the meeting ran into a problem at Legislative Council, and it was to have the enforcement and penalty provisions in the Dash Fives be reference to each of our licensing statutes, so that a violation of my client members of this bill would be subjected to the enforcement and penalties of its statute, et cetera, et cetera. As I understand it, although I haven't talked with counsel, the problem with that is that it means that each of us is treated differently with respect to the same violation, which in fact also happens already in lots of other areas of our statutes, but I guess this one caused a problem at Legislative Council. We have, I think, a solution to that problem, although it was not developed in time to make a Dash 6. And with the chair's work with us, we would hope to, if you pass the Dash 5s, implement that on the House side. The Dash 5s, I think, are preferable from a number of perspectives. They use the guidance that we are all either living under or as regulated lenders, and it treats us all the same with respect to the same kind of lending activities, and we think that's preferable. It's also been worked out on a national level, so there's at least a degree of uniformity across state lines. These are the guidelines adopted by the Commission on State Bank Examiners and the, as the council said, the mortgage lender regulators, these are two associations of which Oregon is a member, and so all states have had some input in adopting these guidelines. It's the consensus view of what all these regulators nationally do. So we would prefer the Dash 5s.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Martinez?
With work.
Yes, I understand.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm in favor of the Dash 6s.
Real funny, Mr. Martinez.
they are not before you here today, but that would be our first, second, and third preference that you give Legislative Council until Monday to draft those. Our concern, I'm not sure I'm here advocating on behalf of the Dash 2s, which I think is how you invited me up to the table, so I may not be the right person for that, but when I showed folks in my association the 2s and the 4s, even with the understanding that we were doing some work on the civil penalties piece, which I think we'll ultimately get to, but we're not there today, when they looked at the 2s and the 4s, they said, well, the 2s clearly take us out of the bill. So my response to that is that, yeah, but we're all trying to work together to have some uniform across the lenders in the state. Having said that, you know, again, I realize we're running out of time here. It would be much more preferable if we could wait till Monday to do it. Other than that, you know, I think it's the committee's choice. We certainly would hope that the chair would make it very clear on the record, both here and on the floor, whoever carried the bill, that there was additional work to be done on this bill, and it was certainly not in any final form here today. We are actually having a special executive committee meeting of the OBA tomorrow morning, specifically on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Your comments are well taken, and I will say again, I do appreciate everybody's work on this, and Kate Newhall and Jim Olesky has been helping facilitate that, and I think really appreciate, in fact, the understanding, because I want to make it clear that I think everybody at the table, including all of our lending partners, understand this issue and want to make sure that that quote bad actors are not, you know, part of the Oregon scene. So, but having said that, there are still some things we can work on, and they're not they're more time oriented than they are great disagreement. And so what I want to do is get the bill moving. We're going to continue to meet to resolve some of these issues that we know are resolvable, except for time on our Senate side of this issue. The Dash 2, again, colleagues, are those issues that we're coming together with, trying to find some resolution on item by item. The Dash, what is now the Dash 5, is taking those uniform federal guidelines and codifying those, but again, trying to resolve some uniformity in terms of how people would be treated penalty-wise, which we're still trying to work on. I'm open to either one of those. I really would like to see what the committee would like to do in terms of advancing the 2 or the 5 as the product that we're going to move on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
I'd make a motion on the 5s if there was enough votes to do that, and I'm relying on your commitment that this bill will be continued to be worked, and you'll work cooperatively with everybody that's infected on this. You know, and it's not my preference to move a bill out of committee that's undone, but I'm more comfortable with the fives and the twos, and with your commitment that this bill will be continued to be worked. That's the direction that I would go if there's the votes in the committee.
Thank you, Senator. So Senator Starr has moved the dash five amendment. So discussion.
All right, Chair.
Senator George.
If I could, in the, what I want to make sure is that we're not outlining any particular loan product. So, like, for instance, reverse mortgages, mortgages where you're paying only partial part of the interest for cash flow purposes, do the Dash 5s in any way outlaw those? To me, it's a financial tool that some people use. I understand that some people use them as a, I suppose, a predatory lending practice, but I've actually looked at those things as a cash management system. So I want to make sure that we're not taking tools off the table for people who are who can handle those kind of things. I don't mind having information about the impacts, but I know the Dash 2s definitely do, so I'd be opposed to the Dash 2s, but what about the Dash 5s?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, the Dash 5s set standards that a lender would have to follow in order to make that kind of a loan, and the assumption is that in many cases that kind of a loan is not appropriate, but it does not outlaw those kinds of loans. It sets standards that the lender would have to evaluate in order to determine whether that loan product was appropriate.
Mr. Chair, as I understand, those standards are set by rule. Is that correct? And I guess that I'd be interested to see exactly what kind of boundaries we're talking about on that. If it's providing information, I think it's absolutely appropriate. If it's actually banning those kind of tools, I'd be...
Mr. Tatman, would you come forward for the department? Maybe that might be an appropriate question for you.
I don't mean to stretch this out. I'd like to understand a little bit.
Did you hear the question from Senator George?
I did.
Yeah. And identify yourself, please.
Yes, I will. My name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities for the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I did hear the question from Senator George. As I look at 965-5 on page 9, I think that's a good example. If you turn to page 9, if you've got it in front of you, line 9, which is subsection 3, and it's talking about the standards. And it says, lenders shall directly inform potential borrowers choosing a non-traditional mortgage product, which includes that negative amortization you were talking about, of the risks associated with the product, including but not limited to the likelihood of increased future payment obligations. The lender shall provide the information required by this subsection before originating the non-traditional product. And it goes on, the information required by this subsection is in addition to any information disclosed. So I think your question was, is it going to be a ban, or is it going to be making sure that necessary information is disclosed so the person can make an intelligent decision? I believe that's the goal of 965, that they make the determination somebody can make an informed decision and that they're not blindsided by the consequences down the road.
And that's what I Mr. Chair, to follow up real quickly. That's exactly what I was hoping you'd say, which makes me more comfortable with it. I guess my concern is on page 6, on lines basically 7 through 11, and it basically describes those non-traditional types of mortgage products and then says the borrowers, you cannot issue those kind unless other risk and mitigating factors support the underwriting decision and the borrower's repayment capacities as required by department rules. So it seems like to me that you guys are going to write some rules in that area under the Dash 5s. And the only thing I worry about is that, in essence, you guys could write rules that would make it almost impossible to use those kind of non-traditional mortgage-type systems. And so I just was wondering if you guys had an idea, if your department had an idea of where you're going to go with those rules so that we're not banning products, we're providing information.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I understand exactly your point. And when we spoke yesterday, I believe, at the hearing, we indicated some preference for this at the time for, because we didn't want to ban outright products, but we wanted to put limitations on that. If you flip over, and I don't want to prolong this anymore either, Section 5 says, demonstrate risk mitigating factors that support the underwriting decision, and then goes on to give us guidance, I think. Risk mitigating factors, line 26 of page 5, are not limited to but include higher credit scores, lower loan-to-value, debt-to-income ratios, significant liquid assets, mortgage insurance, or other credit enhancements. So I think what we would be tasked with is trying to determine what other credit enhancements would fit within those general guidelines for lenders to consider before they made a determination this was an appropriate loan. Again, we wouldn't be saying, we wouldn't pile on so many limitations they couldn't make that loan. We would say these are the factors you need to weigh off against the risks or the downside of that type of loan.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right, so we have a motion on the dash fives. Do I have nods that this is the direction we want to go, or should we just find out? Let's... see if there's any objection. Any objection to adopting the dash five?
Yes, thank you. I feel that the dash fives don't go far enough. I've just had too many experiences with at-risk families that have gone into very poor mortgage lending practices, and they have. And so I was hoping that we would follow the lines of at least including the flipping banning the flipping and banning the negative amortization, and even looking going as far as the other prepayment penalties, etc. But I'm willing to go along with the committee. But I was certainly hoping that. We could maybe pass the dash twos and have them work a little bit more on the House side.
I know we have, and again, just to reiterate, either version is going to continue to be worked on. Any other thoughts on that, though? And again, I want to make sure it's very clear to the committee, I am open to either one, so I'm just trying to see which product that we continue to work, what direction on the product we continue to work on.
I'd be opposed to the dash twos.
Okay.
I'll do the twos or the fives.
Okay.
Or 25s.
Okay. all right. I think I know where we're going. So let's take a roll call on the dash five amendment, please.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator
Decker. Can you skip me? I'll do aye.
Senator Montes Anderson.
No.
Senator
Starr.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so the dash fives are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved 965 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection to that motion? So ordered, and I will ask Senator Avakian to carry that bill. Okay, now let's go to our other. Because I got so much stuff on my desk. Yes.
Yes.
Let me see where I put 443. Okay. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 863. Colleagues, this is we amended this yesterday. I also distributed to you the front page of the New York Times that Representative Shoffler gave us on the automatic dialing calls. I will say, as I said before, that I would like to do a lot more on this, but our Constitution is limited on that. I think the best thing we can do right now is to provide those limited sideboards that 863 does provide. But I sincerely believe that over time the public is going to have a significant weighing in on this. But I think making sure that subscribers' lines are not taken, that we don't manipulate or give false information, I think is a real important move on that. At least it's an improvement over the status quo. So
Mr. Chair,
I would entertain a motion on that.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 863 as amended to Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator.
Which amendment?
We've already amended it.
Yes.
Yeah. So Senate Bill 863 has been moved to the floor as amended to the due pass. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I just, I'm not in love with this bill, but I appreciate your work on it and the fact that you've really worked to accommodate concerns from those of us that are on the committee and those in the public that identified issues with it. I'm willing to vote to move it along and watch how it proceeds across the floor and over to the House. I think that is an issue of folks really being irritated with these particular calls, especially during campaign season. So I think it's one that deserves the debate, and I'm willing to help to facilitate that debate.
Thank you, Senator. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I want to echo Senator Starr's comments about your willingness to work with us on this. I took this bill home after we amended to make sure that I was okay with it, and then I didn't get to read it all the way through. I'm going to vote no in committee here with the reservation that I think I'm probably going to vote yes on the floor, but I want to make sure that at least my objection is heard at this time until I get a full read. I want to tell you how much I appreciate, honestly, your work to try to accommodate a lot of our concerns and other concerns on this. I think you went a long ways to do that, and you made a good effort, and I just unfortunately didn't follow up and respond by reading through. And I also do want to declare a potential conflict of interest on the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Any other discussion? Okay. Would you take the roll?
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Senator
George?
Nope.
Aye. Senator
Starr? Aye. Senator Hester? Aye. Senate Bill 863 had received a majority, is declared passed, and I will carry that one. Okay. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 443, Oregon Community Power. Janet.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to quickly punt on this one.
Okay.
We have two sets of amendments. We were assuming that everything in the dash seven amendments, which were changed from what you had in the dash six amendments at the hearing, the dash seven amendments added a timeline and deadlines for cities and counties to act and react and to form their advisory negotiating committees. A review committee. The dash 10s do not incorporate, as my understanding, the changes that were in the dash 7s. And the dash 10s can be explained by the proponents of specific court rule by Senator Decker. Okay. But that's what I'm going to say.
Thank you. Senator Decker, do you want to bring those representatives and yourself to the dais and explain that amendment then to us? Would that
sure.
be helpful?
I'll bring myself.
And yeah. Well, I'd ask them to come up just because of the time rather than march people up.
So I think, they're all up.
So right. Mr. Bolton, Mr.
Up, Pacific Corps is up.
Gallagher.
Cobb, do you want to, can I stay here? Since
yes, you may.
And then
so why don't you tell us what we're looking at, and then we'll get comments from them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have, after the first hearing, and you heard my passionate plea for some organized, thoughtful process of customers being able to come together and think through how, in the unfortunate and hopefully unlikely scenario, that they would be able to come forward in a thoughtful manner and establish an Oregon Community Power, and since then have sat down with Mr. Bolton, Mr. Gallagher, Brenda McCarthy, and Mr. Bissonnette, along with many others, and tried to work out amendments that might accommodate concerns, and would thank certainly thank PacifiCorps and PGE for, I know, burning hours and hours of attorney time, probably more than I realize, of attorney time and their own time to give you the dash sevens and the dash tens.
Okay, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Tom Gallagher representing PGE. Let me walk you through the dash seven amendments. And I'm not going to, I'll give you section references if you want, but I think it's better if I just walk through a schematic so you understand what's in the density of section, basically section two. The way it would happen under this bill is if a utility enters into an agreement with a buyer and makes a notice to the PUC of an intent for the buyer to acquire the utility or a major portion of the utility, that triggers the operation of Oregon Community Power. And what would happen then is that either the utility and the buyer can go out to the counties under section sub 9 of section 2, and the counties and cities would say we have no interest, and then that original proceeding with the new buyer and the utility could proceed through the PUC, or the cities and the counties would form their acquisition committee, and the acquisition committee would begin to consider, in consultation with the customers, whether or not they wanted to proceed to buy the utility. And if they decide not to, there's a provision in there in Section 2.4b to notify the PUC that they've decided not to go forward. If they decide to go forward, they have 60 days to organize. And that was one of the timeline things that we were hoping for. It's 60 days from the notice. So they have plenty of time to get themselves together and take a look at whether or not they want to make an offer here. At the end of 60 days, they would, or whenever they're organized, they would enter into negotiations with the utility. And the utility would have the right to accept the offer or to refuse the offer. That's under Section 24B. If the utility accepts the offer, or if the utility and the Oregon Community Power want to extend the negotiations beyond 150 days, they can go to the PUC and request an extension of time. At the end of that time period, the utility will either have continued its relationship with the original buyer, or they will have formed a new relationship to be purchased by Oregon Community Power. And as soon as they decide and they come to an agreement, then they will pick up the process in 757-511 in front of the PUC, and the PUC will apply the same standards to this new purchase agreement as they would have applied to the original, in other words, the net benefit standards that they have in rule. So the customers now enter into a full-blown discussion with the PUC on this purchase agreement. At the end of that time, when the PUC approves the agreement, Oregon Community Power would own the utility. Most of those provisions are contained in Section 2. And what PGE was looking for here was a timeline, which is in there, 60 days to organize, 150 days with extension possibilities to make the purchase, and that the purchase would go through the PUC process where all the customers and all of the other interested parties are involved in the agreement. In 7, there's a slight change in Section 11B under eminent domain. There are two eminent domain sections there. The 11B section makes certain that eminent domain is not used to coerce any of the parties to conclude this agreement. Otherwise, eminent domain remains the same as it was before. The other three changes are changes that were proposed by the customers, and I'll let Mr. Bessonnet go through those.
Mr. Bessonnet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB represents the residential ratepayers, and we are a private not-for-profit organization but have statutory standing to represent the those ratepayers. This is a bill that had has had some history behind it, particularly last session, when there was a real situation sort of facing us as a state and us as ratepayers in terms of the future of the state's largest electric utility. There was a lot of good work done on that bill, and I think Senator Deckert wanted to bring that forward in an atmosphere which was a little less charged, if you'll excuse the pun. Where we're not, facing a specific situation, and there's value to looking at some of that. We asked for a couple of clarifying things, particularly the definition of customer, and throughout, as customers are referred to, it's specifically customers with billing accounts. Just to be clear of when customers have to be consulted with, that's who we're talking about. We had also, when there is a in Section 2, Sub 5, we wanted to make sure that the Acquisition Review Committee, which was formed by the cities and counties, if they were going to take a vote to approve entering into negotiations for the purchase of a utility, that they consult with customer representatives, and that is reflected here. Also in section 14, sub 2, when the Acquisition Review Committee requests money to conduct negotiations and due diligence for the potential purchase of a utility, we asked, since the customer is going to be on the hook to repay that amount of money, that there ought to be some kind of process at the PUC, that a letter just not be able to be given and money transferred, but there's a hearing and some detail as to what the Acquisition Committee is going to actually proposing to do with those funds. And so that is, again, reflected in Section 14, Sub 2. And lastly, in Section 27, in regard to power from the Bonneville Power Administration, again, either power benefits, either in the form of power or money. We just wanted to be clear that any creation of Oregon Community Power through the purchase of any utility didn't harm the existing benefits that ratepayers were getting either in direct power or the financial equivalent. And Section 27, Part F, or Sub 1F, clarifies that. And with that, there is this bill, you know, does have some value in that if we find ourselves again in a situation as we found ourselves in last or 2 years ago, it might be nice to have this on the books as a as kind of a safety net for ratepayers. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Bolton. Any comments you'd like to make at all?
Sure. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Scott Bolton for Pacific Corp. I'm here to really speak to the Dash 10 amendments, so that's appropriate. I can do that right now.
Okay.
It's a pretty thick document, but really our amendments are pretty brief and all contained within Section 2 of the bill. We asked, Pacific Corp has a much different ownership structure than Portland General Electric or even Idaho Power. We have four shareholders, rather than you know, thousands or tens of thousands, as may be the case with a publicly traded company. And so we ask for recognition of that in Section 2, Sub 1, Big B, which simply clarifies that the company has to be for sale. Just the addition or subtraction of our current shareholder base could trigger a 511 proceeding. We didn't want that to be to set Oregon Community Power in action alone. We wanted to make sure that it recognized that there may be major transfers of ownership of Pacific Corp simply because any additions or subtractions to shareholders will appear that way under our current structure. And so the company has to actually be for sale with more than 50% of the voting shares going to a non-affiliated business. The two other changes that or additions that we asked for are Section 2, Sub 7, and Sub 8. And both of these reflect Pacific Corp's multi-state nature. We're also organized and provide service much differently than Portland General Electric. We serve six western states, just over 1.7 million customers, two-thirds of which are outside of Oregon. And so Section 7 simply requires Oregon Community Power to go through the same regulatory approval process with those other state PUCs or regulatory commissions as any other purchaser would go through. We think that's an important customer protection. And then Sub 8 recognizes that because we're an integrated system, investments have been made on behalf of Oregon that should be reflected in the negotiation and the potential sale to Oregon Community Power. And also Sub E recognizes that we have to reintegrate what's left of the system if Oregon were to be sold, the Oregon Service Territory were to be sold to Oregon Community Power. An example of this is our California Service Territory would basically become an island within our system. And so we just want to make very clear to the regulators and customers in other states that their rights and our obligation to ensure that they still receive, you know, safe, reliable, and affordable electricity is preserved under Oregon Community Power.
Okay. Mr. Bolton, I just have one question on that, and that is, since, and correct me where I'm wrong on this, or Senator Deckard might chime in, since we're not allowing the condemnation authority to actually take the utility, that it actually has to be agreed upon sale, wouldn't all those elements be in an agreed upon sale, or you would say no? I mean, wouldn't that be kind of almost part and parcel to the negotiation process?
Chair Metzger, we just want to make absolutely clear that what may be in the economic interest of the business and what may make sense for Oregon customers may not necessarily be in the economic interest or make sense for customers of other states. So really what Oregon Community Power, if that's invoked in a case like Pacific Corp, you really are talking about the breakup of the integrated system. And we just want to make very clear what the costs and obligations are with that action.
This just puts everybody on notice.
You have any comment on the dash 10 versus your 7 and the reason for that inclusion?
Mr. Chair, I was persuaded. I talked to Mr. Bolton a great deal about that very question I asked him. And I think the response of you could foresee where the offer was so good from Oregon Community Power that you'd want to protect ratepayers in California, Utah, and other jurisdictions, and this gets you that. So even if we did something for Oregon, they have a responsibility, obviously, to ratepayers.
So you're supportive of the 10?
I'm a supportive of the 7s and the 10s.
Okay, just wanted to make clear. Did you have some comments you wanted to make? I wasn't sure.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy with PGE. I just would like to highlight just a couple of points that we're satisfied that the PUC is involved, which was a very important piece to us, and that ultimately this is a voluntary transaction with the utility. So those are two big pieces.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. And I appreciate your work on this, and I appreciate, as expected, your tenacity on this issue, Senator Deckard, and moving with it. I do agree with you that it is a good idea, I think, public policy, to have a mechanism where you have a lot of jurisdictions, if some situation occurs, of how they're going to get together to do what they're going to do, and you don't have renegade cities and counties making threats and doing things, and there needs to be an organized process for that. But I also think, and I think your work has reflected that but it should be just like any other potential purchaser should be able to sit across the table and make a legitimate business offer and acceptance or rejection as opposed to the threat of condemnation if you don't see it our way. I think you found that balance. I think you found the protections that would be needed and would allow these different municipalities that might be engaged in a service area of a utility a mechanism to come together in some organized factor and make that type of offer. I really do appreciate your work on that. Questions? Okay, I guess it would be our preference, Senator Deckard, for the dash 10s. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash 7 and dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 443.
We need both?
We do need both.
Okay, thank you. So, let's take them one at a time, Senator. How about the dash 7? Okay, Senator Starr has moved the dash 7 amendment to Senate Bill 443. Discussion on that amendment. Any objection on that amendment? It's ordered.
Move the dash 10.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 10 amendment to Senate Bill 443. Discussion on that amendment. Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is submitted to the Senate floor with a due process recommendation.
And I think what we need to do, Senator, thank you. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senator Deckard is going to make his case to the Senate President.
It doesn't
have to go there, but because it does have reference, if we could amend it to make that request, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 443 be sent as amended sent to the Senate floor with a due process recommendation and that the referral to Ways and Means be rescinded by the Senate President.
Okay. You heard Senator Starr's motion. I won't repeat it. Any objection to that motion?
No.
Senator George.
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, I'm very reluctant on this bill. Obviously, I think the 7s and the 10s get me closer to where I'm a little more comfortable with it. I haven't read the 7 and 10s all the way through. And so I guess what I'd like to do is that just generally I'm nervous about public entities buying private businesses. And so what I'd like to do is vote no in committee and, again, put myself in a situation once I read the 7s and 10s to feel more and more comfortable. I think I could be convinced, but I just at this point with these amendments coming the way across and this issue being so complex that I'll vote no and then follow the issue a little more closely.
Thank you, Senator. That's totally understandable. The 10s were rather warm. And fortunately for most of the committee, you know, we've dealt with this issue for now two sessions, so we have some familiarity with it. But I understand that, and that's certainly understood.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator. Sir.
I too am not. I'm not in love with the idea of having our private utilities purchased on the public side. I voted against the bills that were moved through last year, the last session. So that's a courtesy to move this debate along, get it to Senate floor. We can have a broader discussion. I'm willing to vote to move it on.
Okay. So let's go ahead and take the roll.
Senator
Moss
Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Becker? I'll do a courtesy vote, yes.
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 4-3, having received constitutional majority, is declared pass, and we will send it to the President's desk with the request that it have the Ways and Means rescinded, and we'll see what he says about that one. And Senator Deckard, you'll be asked to carry that bill. Okay, where are we? This is we don't have 855 yet. Okay, Senator Ross Anderson. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 424.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 424.
Okay. Senator Ross Anderson has moved the Dash
3 amendments. We're going to get ahead of everybody this time.
To Senate Bill 424. So now we're going to have a discussion. Janet, would you please describe the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 424?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 3 amendments are similar in the first two sections to the Dash 2 amendments that you had a previous hearing on. They do prohibit an Oregon agency from expending funds to implement the Federal Real ID Act unless sufficient federal funds are allocated to cover the estimated cost. And they do require ODOT to analyze and report on the cost of implementing the Real ID Act prior to its implementation. Going on to Section 3, requires ODOT to analyze and compare with the Real ID implementation cost the cost of funding citizen applications for passports. And the Section 4 authorizes, the new Section 4 authorizes the Attorney General, with the approval of the Governor, to challenge the legality or constitutionality of the Real ID Act. Backing up a bit, it does the end of Section 2, it does require ODOT to provide reasonable security measures to protect individual privacy and to prevent unauthorized disclosure before issuing real ID compliant identification.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Janet. Colleagues, this is we've had a number of hearings on this bill and a work session discussion on it. It's extremely complicated. And the ramifications of, I think I mentioned the first time we had a public hearing, are pretty significant no matter what we do. I know a lot of you have had your views on different parts of this act, as do members of our colleagues in the Senate. And I honestly would say that I don't think at this late in a session on a major piece of legislation that have I found so many varied opinions on I mean, where they're really to coalesce around a major direction has been unable to be found, and but all for different reasons, and it is remarkable. The Dash 3 amendments, the origin of those, if you go way back, these essentially are the Dash 1 amendment with two added procedures, and one of which was suggested actually by Senator Walker. Regarding the issuance of passports, and it was originally said in jest that it probably would be cheaper to help people for their $80 of buying their passport than it would be to implement the Real ID Act if people's concern are about flying on airplanes. The final section came from the legislation just passed by Washington and signed by Governor Gregoire, allowing the Attorney General to question even the constitutionality of the Real ID Act. As you know, since we've had our last meetings, with Idaho and Montana and Washington have rejected the Real ID Act in addition to other states, we do have rules, and Lorna Young has done a great job of going over the proposed rules. I think one of the problems that we have is that we don't know what they are going to be final, and but one thing that I have found, and I've reflected a lot on this issue, and that is, I believe there is, my own personal view is, this is probably an ultimate states' rights issue that I've ever faced in the legislature, in which the federal government is really going way beyond the pale, in my view, to tell states what to do. There's some things in the Real ID Act that I think are positive. I said, for example, on the record before, I support a legal presence requirement, and I do. I think we can do that within Oregon's own parameter. We don't have to do it within the guideline of a Real ID Act. I think those types of decisions should be Oregon decisions. The very fact that we can have a possibility of telling our citizens, at least on some modes of travel, they can't travel within their own United States unless they conform to an act that people have tremendous amount of privacy for it. The cost, which we really don't know what the cost is, but it's the best understanding of ODOT in the next few years, at least almost $70 million, but maybe more. I just think there's a lot of issues there, and I think the federal government needs to rethink the Real ID Act, the role of the federal government versus the role of the states. And I think we're moving towards, with the passage of 640 last session, making more secure driver's license. I think we can continue to do that and should do that. But I don't think we need to do that as a mandate. And I'd like to have Oregon, and as I talk to many of my colleagues, agree to join most of our Western colleagues and tell the federal government that this is an Oregon issue and it's not one that should be imposed by the federal government. So that's my my overview. What I would like to do is have comments from the committee. I'll ask a couple people to step forward by invitation to get some thoughts on them, and we'll move ahead. Comments on this issue?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. You know, this is an issue that, in my role as the chair of the NCSL Transportation Committee, I've spent a fair amount of time on. In fact, I was in Washington, D.C. last week, and I spent 6 hours on Capitol Hill talking to members and their staff about this particular issue. And our message from the NCSL to our friends at the federal level is a fix and fund message. That the Real ID, you know, it, no question, I agree with you on the states' rights issue and the philosophically the federal usurpation of the role that we have on driver's licenses. But the message really is one of providing, and as you know, the Department of Homeland Security has draft rules out right now, open for public comment. We expect that final rules will be issued sometime in mid-late summer. But the message is to fix it, to provide the states more flexibility, to lengthen the re-enrollment period. Today, if the rule stands, we'll have to bring all Oregonians through this re-enrollment period in a three-year period of time, significantly increasing the cost to the state of Oregon. So the request would be to extend that to 2017 rather than 2013. We've asked that the federal government come up with at least $1 billion to help get states down the road to implementation of this particular federal mandate. Also, the needed infrastructure for the states to do the document verification. No, it doesn't exist today. Yeah. And we've asked that the federal government, before they require the states to go along with this, that infrastructure be in place. And it's not today. You know, we couldn't become Real ID compliant, nor could any other state, for that matter, be Real ID compliant with the effective date of this act as it was drafted or passed by the Congress originally. So those are issues that, and those are messages that state legislators and our staff at NCSL are communicating with the folks at the congressional level. I think a number of those things have to be resolved through congressional action. Some of them may be able to be resolved through rulemaking and additional rulemaking through the Department of Homeland Security. We will see. On a philosophical level, Mr. Chair, I have very little to disagree with the statements you made, and you know, moving forward on the Dash 3 amendment. However, I think that we could, as a state, we should, as a state, deal with a piece of this that's really important, and I think that's the legal presence piece. I don't think that there's anybody that believes that ultimately Real ID 1, I don't believe it'll be repealed. I believe that we'll be forced at some level to move in this direction, and I think we might as well do this sooner rather than later, and their legal presence piece is really important. As we've heard testimony, virtually every state in the nation already does this. It's not complicated. It's not difficult for our Department of Motor Vehicles to accomplish. And I think it's important for really, as you look at the role of our state and the immigration issue, you know, whether or not this is connected to Real ID or not, under this bill, obviously it is. And under the Real ID, I think ultimately we're going to have to accommodate. It will be. I'm convinced of that. And so we might as well take that step today. And that's why I'll be opposing the Senate Bill 424 with the Dash 3s, and I expect that Senator George and I may provide an opportunity to have that vote or that discussion on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator Starr, for your comments, and thank you also for your leadership on NCSL on this and many other issues.
And can I just, yes. one more thing. I wanted to make everybody aware that there is a Real ID town hall meeting. There's not a lot of opportunities for the average citizen to comment on these rules, but there is one. And it's a town hall meeting Tuesday, May 1st, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University of California, Davis, Freeborn Hall. So if you're in California, you can go. but there's more. It gets better. You can also participate via the Internet at real, and the Internet address is www.realidtownhall.com. All one word, realidtownhall.com. So for members of the public, members that are in this audience that want to participate in a public hearing, get your comments on the record as it relates to this DHS rulemaking, as it relates to Real ID, you do have that opportunity. And as legislators, we have a Real ID webinar, and if you want information on that, whereas legislators, we can provide additional comment to DHS on the rules. That is on May 4th, and I can get, if legislators are interested in that, I can get information for that.
Thank you. Senator Starr makes all his announcements because he can't do it on a robocall now, so we can do it in the committee. So. Thank you very much for that. Also, we'll note to members that we were handed out a letter that we just received today from the city of Eugene, who is opposed to Real ID, the Real ID Act. Lorna Youngs, would you please come forward? I think it's important, and since you represent the department, to get your thoughts on this. And you've been very kind in addressing this committee a number of times on what's going forward, and I did listen to the House testimony yesterday on this, and would like to have your comments on the record on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the DMV at the Department of Transportation. In reading through what this bill would do, my understanding is that after the effective date of this bill, the department would cease any activity towards its implementation. And my assumption would be that that would also mean any activity towards requesting or developing any kind of plan for an extension, which is one of the things that is required by the rule. So that would be important to have clarified to the department that by moving this forward, you are instructing the department not to ask for that extension. And so under the assumption that federal funding will not be forthcoming anytime soon, we would cease any activity on the Real ID Act itself, but instead would put our energy into developing the reports as required in Section 3. Is my understanding of what we are being instructed to do correct?
I think the Section 1, Ms. Youngs, forbids the agency from expending funds to implement Real ID. And I understand what you're saying. What you could be an interpretation of yours when you talk about requesting an extension on considering that. Is that the area that you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is. Because the extension, while it is needs to be in October of this year, within 6 months of granting that extension, the department must develop a compliance plan for how we would proceed towards implementation. And so it would be my assumption that work on a compliance plan towards implementation would be working towards implementation. So we could submit the extension request, because if this bill doesn't have an emergency clause on it, its effective date is January 1st, 2008. But the compliance plan effort, my assumption would be the language of this bill would prohibit us from actually developing the compliance plan, because it is a plan towards implementing. If I'm incorrect, then I'd need some direction.
Yeah. My comment on that, Ms. Jones, that it would be incorrect. And by the way, we did, as you probably recognize, that specific language came directly out of the Washington legislation that Governor Gregoire just signed. And the fact that it does not have an emergency clause means that those things do not take effect until January 1, 2008. And so those restrictions on asking for an extension are not part of law. At the time of October, had this had an emergency clause, then you are correct that could have been interpreted that way.
Mr. Chair. However, the compliance plan itself is not due until April of 2008 or some date thereafter, and we would be working on the development of that compliance plan after January. And so it is that point that I need clarification on, because the request for the extension is simply writing a letter.
Right.
Developing a compliance plan is doing work.
Well, and that is one of the benefits, I guess, of having our February session that will be with us right after that, when at which time hopefully all the rules will be final, and we'll know exactly what direction, and that debate will be reignited, I'm sure, in February of 2008. One thing, it is very difficult. I know it's difficult for the department. I think it's difficult for members, difficult for people involved with this issue, is to decide a specific direction without knowing exactly what that means and making a policy choice. And so that's where I fall back on the issue, which is the core issue of the state's rights issue to assert its own sovereignty on these issues over the federal government. But realizing, as Senator Starr mentioned, that this debate isn't going to end, I don't anticipate the Real ID Act will disappear. But it could look, it could be a totally different looking animal. And I think the state of Oregon, I believe, has an obligation to help lead that debate and to express its sovereignty on these issues. And I do believe that there will be further looks at this issue as that time goes on.
Thank you for your clarification. So we understand that we are not prohibited from requesting an extension by the Senate. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Shanks?
I do. I'm looking through my file up here, and I'm only finding a memo from you from February 22nd. Seems like we had you testify after that as well, and I'm not finding that memo in my file. So if after the hearing, if you can just have somebody send me a copy of your testimony, because it had the part I'm most interested in is the costs, and the costs that are in this February 22nd memo, I think, are different than the one that we had most recently.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'd be happy to forward that to you. What I provided was an update, informational update on the rules. And since that time of that informational update, we have recalculated costs and added approximately $4 million. So we are looking at close to $70 million instead of $65.5 as we were looking at before.
Okay. Yeah, updated information would be terrific. Thank you.
Yes.
Somehow I have a funny feeling that this might be the tram expense of that will continue to grow. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Youngs? This is not a public hearing, but I will ask if there's anyone else who wants to comment on this issue in the next couple minutes. So, okay. Any concerns about the amendment? Not the topic, but of the amendment. If there is somebody, you have a question about something in the amendment? You'd have to come forward, please, sir.
My name is Leonard McMichael. My question is basically on the amendment itself. Are you sending the message out to the DMV that you're not going to require them to check for legal status in Oregon of those people? Or what my concern is the
what people are you talking about?
Any person in the country that is not legally here, that is applying for a driver's license that doesn't supply proper identification. Oregon is becoming a state where we can go down and get IDs under multiple names based on not hard evidence or identification.
Well, fortunately, that's not going to be the case now after the passage of Senate Bill 640, which is going to keep people from having multiple driver's licenses and with our central issuances. What this does, sir, is just says we're not going to comply with the federal Real ID Act is what it says.
Okay, so basically you're just not, and I don't have a problem with that issue. Yeah. I just don't want to make sure that the impressed or implied meaning is that we're going to back off on requiring Real ID.
As I mentioned before, and I think Senator Starr mentioned, there are other avenues that the state is part of our sovereign right to pursue protecting the integrity of our own driver's licenses, and I think those are going to continue. The question is whether we do it under the context of a federal mandate that has other issues with it, and I think those debates are going to continue as well. But I do believe they should be Oregon decisions, not tied to other requirements.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Any other comments from the committee? Okay, so we have a dash three amendment before us. Let's take a look.
Chamber Starr?
No.
Senator
George?
Aye.
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Senator
Monson-Anderson?
Aye.
Chairman Starr? Aye. The amendment's adopted. Senator
Monson-Anderson. I move Senate Bill 424 as amended to the full Ways and Means.
Well, what we need to do, Senator, since we're this is actually not doing it, the Ways and Means could be
we can get
rescinded,
rid of that.
So, but you have to request that. So if you can make the motion.
All right,
then
I'll
go
send
to
it to the floor with
it.
A due pass recommendation with a letter to the President asking that the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay, Senator Monson-Anderson has moved Senate Bill 424 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the request that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded. Discussion. Senator
sure.
George.
I appreciate the dash three amendments. I really philosophically agree with what the chair is doing there. Although I'm with Senator Starr, I think we should have dealt with a legal presence issue. So I supported the amendments, and I like it much better than the original bill, but I'd sure like so I'm going to vote no because I'd like to see the legal presence issue brought forward.
Okay. Thank you. And I anticipate that will happen. Can we take a roll?
Senator George?
Nope.
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Aye.
No, and I serve notice of a minority report.
I can't serve notice until I'm done.
Sorry.
Aye. Senate Bill 424, I received a constitutional majority.
I don't do this often enough in this committee.
Has been passed. Senator Starr.
So now, I serve notice.
Okay. All right.
Potential, possible.
Okay,
minority.
Senator Starr has served notice of potential minority. Yeah. Who knows what that will do. Okay, thank you all. Now, where are we next? Do we have... All right, so let's open up a public hearing on SJR 33, and this is an amendment, colleagues.
Hey, what has Drew got on his computer back here that half the committee room?
Everybody's looking at it.
Can Drew bring that up and let us all see what
he's not listening to?
Mr. Hagedorn, people are questioning your computer in the back of the room, and he's not listening to anybody. So let's just move on. Senate Joint Resolution 33, colleagues, originally started out as a constitutional referral on the robocall, but what we have done is had an amendment on Senate Joint Resolution 33, and since Janet's busy, I'll just explain what it does. Essentially, if I can find my, my copy in front of me, you have the dash one, please. This actually has evolved out of a number of discussions that Senator Starr and others have had regarding transportation funding. We all have a real concern that is shared by many people that we don't have adequate resources for our highway system. We have met with advocates from all walks that we need more resources. And it's been very clear, especially a number of the business groups in the state have made it very clear that that we can't wait on that. We have a plan in place that we have started moving forward yesterday, which I think is an important part of that. But I know there's a lot of angst that we need to raise money now to begin some of that discussion and get projects moving. And frankly, we were pretty well challenged to say the money, we need to raise the money, and we need that this is more important than some of the other issues. So we took that to heart, tried to find a way. And so the dash one represents a formula that Senator Morris devised relating to the personal kicker, money that has already been collected in taxes and is in the Treasury and has been, for the most part, businesses expensed, and seeing if there was a way by capping the kicker at $800 that essentially, according to Senator Morris, means that 75% of all taxpayers get 100% of their kicker. Those upper 25 will be capped at $800. But the net result is up to $479 million would be available for immediate congestion relief. This does have to be referred to the voters. It is constitutional, but we could have a September election and get these get this congestion relief underway. And so this is kind of our response to the charge to be bold and have a debate on finding some real money for it. So we have that before us, and I think what I'm going to do is ask Bernie Bottomley, Duncan Weiss, and is Chandler in the audience? Yeah, there he is. Come on forward and give us your thoughts on it. These three gentlemen were all involved in in that discussion and represented some of the organizations that were asking for immediate action. So we want to get their thoughts to this. Who would like to start?
Mr. Wise.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm the president of the Oregon Business Council. I want to thank the chair for proposing this. I think it displays your recognition, our shared recognition, that this is a huge issue, and I really want to thank you for it. We learned of this earlier in the week. We've been working on it. I can't today give you a definitive answer through our group, the Oregon Business Council, but again, it reflects, I think, our common interest in developing a package this session that will meet our transportation needs. As you know, the Business Council strongly supports increased investments in transportation this session to increase freight mobility, deal with congestion, safety, and efficiencies in our highways. We've been a partner on the study that Bernie's organization really launched to demonstrate the cost of congestion, and we recognize, as you've heard earlier, that we're going to lose billions of dollars in the years ahead if we don't address our transportation challenges in Oregon. We've joined a broad coalition under the umbrella of the Oregon Business Plan of leaders and organizations advocating for significant increases in transportation, and we firmly do believe that now is the time. This proposal is one significant option which I think we should put on the table for discussion among others. What we have recommended and we took to our board last week was a package of a combination of vehicle registration and gas tax increases that would raise $350 million over time, and we put that on the table. It was another idea, and we'd like to talk about that with the legislature. We know this is an important issue. We have not been unable, given the implications of this proposal, using the personal kicker, raises a whole series of public finance issues, which I'm going to have to get in dialogue with our board and I think the other coalition members as well. But again, I really applaud Senator Metzger's for proposing this, because again, I think it shows your willingness to think boldly, as you said, and that's what we were asking for, bold leadership on this issue. I would point out the proposal we put on the table would not only deal with the state level and some of the critical congestion issues, it would provide an ongoing source of revenue, and it would provide additional dollars for the counties, who I think at this stage are desperately in need for additional revenue. Our goal again is to try to find a way to generate upwards to $350 million per year in additional revenue, which can be used for a variety of transportation-related purposes. I think when you heard some of the folks before you earlier talk about this as an economic issue, I remember Senator George nodding as you heard about the issues of the steel issue, trying to move freight back and forth up and down the valley to McMinnville. I mean, I think you all know those stories. You also know the congestion. We don't need to convince any of you the importance. And again, I really thank this committee and the chair in particular for providing leadership. I really hope we can get to a resolution this session on a great transportation package, and we're more than willing to work with you on it.
Okay, I'll go to the next person, but just one comment first is that in our discussions about moving forward and with cities and counties, and as you are aware in the proposal that we've been advancing collectively here, does entail those types of financing. I think the decision, the question was, since most of those fundings would not kick in until 09 in terms of gas tax or registration fee, perhaps growth, the question was, you know, we needed something now between now, and this $500 million would be more than what would be on the others. So this is designed not as a replacement to that plan, because as you know, we support moving that direction, but to try to answer that call and, you know, getting some money that's already been collected that's available. Mr. Bottomley.
Senator Metzger, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance. We're an association of 1,300 small, medium, and large businesses in the Portland metropolitan area. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'll just echo most of the comments that Duncan made. As you know, we undertook about 3 years ago a regional study on the cost of congestion in the Portland area. It identified some significant costs associated with not investing adequately in the transportation system. That study was a great opportunity to kind of make the business case for investing in transportation, that there really is a cost benefit that is on the positive side in terms of investment. We extended that study to a statewide look this last year, and the analysis has showed that the same kind of dynamic exists on the statewide basis. As Duncan said, we are very much appreciative of all the work that you've done and your thoughtfulness and keeping this issue on the front burner. And we want to continue to work with you. Like Duncan, we haven't had a chance for our members to explore this particular financing mechanism, but we want to continue to work with you and find a solution that that we can get agreement on.
Mr. Bottomley, when do you think we might be able to hear from the PBA on their position on this?
Well, we can certainly work with them on it. I think, whenever you have a new revenue source, it's a difficult issue to have that discussion. So we'll have that with our members, and we can get back to you at some later time.
Okay. Well, one of the things is, not to be curt, but, our discussion was, I believe in one meeting was not one more hour, to wait. So, Senator.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm surprised, quite honestly, that the response both from Mr. Weiss and Mr. Bottomley, that, after our conversations, voices were raised to a certain extent, fists were pounded on tables. Pretty significant commitments were made or promised, to be, this proposal has been out there for at least 48 hours. And it seemed like, it wouldn't be very difficult to pick up the phone and get a sense from, some of the core people that were in those two conversations that Senator Metzger and I both were in, to find out if, if this is a proposal whereby you could start counting votes. Well, that was the promise. You provide leadership, and I think Senator Metzger has done that. And we'll go out and help round up the votes. And I'm a little bit surprised that I'm just hearing, we haven't gotten around to talking about it yet.
Yeah. Let's have Mr. Chandler talk, and then and then we're going to we'll have some questions here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. In various other committees this session, I've made a variation of this speech. For those of you who have heard it before, I apologize. We've been talking about the need for transportation from the home builder standpoint for several legislative sessions. We sometimes think of ourselves as the distant early warning system to tax problems in this state. I'm going to be making this conversation with the Revenue Committee if Representative Lim ever casts his vote on the floor. When local governments need money, particularly for roads, they look to us. We're needing a permit, we come into the counter, we have money in flow, we pay SDCs. In some jurisdictions in the state, system development charges are up over $20,000. That's a lot of money. We understand the need for infrastructure. We've fallen into a trap in this state of assuming that the system development charge system is a way of funding when it's actually just a cost allocation. SDCs for roads or anything else can only be used for new. They don't fix potholes. In some places, in Washington County, this is one of those moments of clarity I had when Washington County started talking about the Bethany expansion area. And this is Washington County. This is a friendly jurisdiction for development. It's a very economically development-oriented jurisdiction. They're talking about fees in excess of $60,000 a lot to pay for the roads because there's no other funding source. Now, I don't think they'll do that. But that's an astonishingly, eye-poppingly large number. It would destroy the economy out there for it to be imposed. It would force the growth elsewhere, and it is a symptom, I believe, of a tax system that is in disrepair. We have talked about changing Measure 5 and 50. We put on the table, and Senator Deckert and I have had this conversation within other issues. If you change Measure 5 and 50 just for new development to raise more money and dedicate it to infrastructure, if you change the valuation system on new development only and dedicate it to infrastructure, we would be supportive of that. We have looked at a variety of topics. This is a new one to me, using the personal kicker. I haven't had a chance to run it by my folks. You could have mine first. As an individual, this state is going to choke on a lack of road money. We are going to choke Mr. Bottomley's organization study, Mr. Wise's organization. I share the urgency as a source of personal and professional frustration that this is the issue that has gotten so little attention pending this proposal, Mr. Chairman, which I very much appreciate. Senator Deckert and I have spent a lot of time this session on an issue that's very important, but less so. And this transportation need is the one that I believe this legislature needs to grapple, must grapple. It will get solved one way or the other. We will stand ready and be happy to participate any way we can from the home builder standpoint in future conversations in trying to push this issue forward. Let us know when the meetings are. We're glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, questions for our panel. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two quick questions. Well, not quick, actually, two questions, if I could. Senator Whitsitt has uncovered some information recently dealing on transportation because his desire to see some things on transportation, that our prevailing wage is significantly higher than
states with similar demographics to us, like Idaho and Utah and other places, and as much as 30 to 50% higher just for prevailing wage, not to mention the free market. This is running our transport, since most of our costs in transportation infrastructure is man hours, there is a huge amount of money being spent to comply with the prevailing wage in this state that other states don't have to, which means they're getting bigger bang for their buck. We've got to spend $1.30 or $1.40 to get $1's worth of product in comparison here. Is there any desire on your organization's part as we go forward as talking about major tax increases on the taxpayers that we start to look at reforming somehow our prevailing wage laws in this state?
Well, I can't speak specifically to the prevailing wage issue. The Portland Business Alliance has long taken the approach that public entities need to be held to a pretty strict standard in terms of how they're allocating their funds and how they're spending them. For example, the Alliance a number of years ago did a comprehensive analysis of the City of Portland's budget and went to the city with a series of suggestions on how they might better spend their dollars. I am getting a little out of my depth here, but I know that a lot of the projects that ODOT works on have federal funds involved, and so that they're obligated under the federal law, and I'm not sure that we can speak to that issue.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chairman, no, just please. Clarify. Actually, the information that Senator Whitsitt has uncovered is that everybody's under the Davis-Bacon Act, and what happens is the way our state calculates what prevailing wage is has put us in a completely different category. So when Utah or Idaho is complying with prevailing wage laws, it is significantly lower than us complying, even though we have similar demographics, similar cost of living, similar things. And all I'm saying is at some point, the business community is going to have to step up. We cannot continue to pass on costs to the average Oregonian when we're not willing to tackle some of the more politically charged issues like where prevailing wage has gone sideways in the state. And that's complying with federal law, too. I understand it's federal law, but prevailing wage is set by the way we do our calculations in Oregon. We got to reform that. And I was just wondering if there's got to be a total comprehensive package on how we spend our transportation dollars.
Mr. Chairman, if I might take a stab at this, and Senator George, I would not want to take a quiz on prevailing wage law, and I'm unfamiliar with the study that Senator Whitsitt did. But as I indicated in my testimony, the new development industry, is already paying for big pieces of the transportation infrastructure in the state. If transportation is as important as I believe it is, and I think the citizens believe it is, and I think the folks who are receiving the prevailing wage would believe it is, then all issues ought to be on the table when we start figuring out how to spend the money, how to collect the money, and what projects to do in what sequence. I'd certainly put our fees on the table and perhaps an increase in system development charges from new development. I would hope that other groups who have a dog in this fight would do the same thing. And if that means we look at the prevailing wage law and how it applies, then we ought to look at the prevailing wage law and how it applies.
No comment. One more quick. Since it seems like we have to have a kind of a discussion on everybody's boards, I was just wondering. One of the ideas that was kicking around was a certain percentage increase in the corporate income taxes dedicated exclusively to transportation. I don't know if you all could comment on that or make sure that your folks have a conversation about that.
I can't. I heard about that.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that really raises one of the policy issues associated with this proposal at hand, which is to take the funds that are currently dedicated to the general fund and put them into the transportation. We have a stream of revenues that are associated with transportation, which is one of the reasons why I couldn't give you a quick answer, because it does raise a set of policy issues that are just beyond on the revenue. I mean, again, our thinking has been the transportation is essentially a standalone part of our public service that has dedicated revenue streams that we use to fund them, and we have not raised, as you are well aware, have not had increases that have kept up with inflation in those streams, and we're therefore having challenges with maintenance, preservation, and for new construction. So to be dedicating general funds, whether it's through a corporate income tax or through the personal kick or any other means, I think raises some pretty significant policy issues that we frankly have not, I mean, until Senator Metzger proposed it, we had not thought about, and I think we need to think hard about it.
Okay. Questions?
I'd like to see the study or the information that first I heard of it.
And on that, again, I'm sorry, I was talking, but we will take a look at that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, just a couple of things. I think that, and one of the things that Senator Morris has under obligations here, and I do appreciate his work in devising the mechanism for this. And one of the things that he pointed out, and we don't have a number on this, but those of you, because you're all involved in transportation, understand that not only in terms of the impact of what we would do with this is that would you have almost $500 million, which is a significant amount of money, but the leverage, the potential leverage of that money with federal dollars when you have cash money, this could double or triple that amount of money for our highway system in very, very short order. And, I can't give you an exact number on that, but we know how those formulas work. So leverage is very important in the transportation system. I think another thing that's intriguing about this is that part of our discussions is we're going to be moving into the interim and talking about providing some additional help to our partners, our cities and our counties that are important partners in our transportation system, is moving to that discussion that we as citizens are all responsible and impacted by transportation, whether we're going to the gas pump or not, because good transportation means a lot of things. For the efficiency of our businesses, our customers come see us, the UPS truck to come and deliver the package to us, that we all are impacted negatively or positively about regarding the quality of our transportation system. And that we do need to expand our horizon of if we all are impacted about it and impacted by it, and we all are responsible for that, then looking for different funding streams for that is appropriate, because that's the only way in which, as a community, I mean, a community of being the state of Oregon, that we're going to be able to move forward on it. What I would ask to do is that we have one more meeting on Monday, but this bill, we have one particular value that we don't have with any other bill. Because it's a revenue bill, I can refer this to the Revenue Committee, where Senator Deckard is, and we are not faced by the same deadline. I'll continue this on Monday. But what I would ask, as Senator Starr has mentioned, is that I want to hear back from the leadership of your organizations on this approach. We've talked about the other approach that you have gone through, and I am happy to also hear your reports on where that might line up with the members of this building, mm-hmm. because I think that it is important to everybody on this committee, as it is with you, that we avail ourselves of all of our opportunities and move transportation forward. So I want to hear back from you on this particular proposal from your leadership. We'll continue this on Monday, and we'll see where we go from there.
Okay.
Any other comments?
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close public hearing on SJR 33. And finally, it's after 2. Well,
you want to do 8:55?
Yeah, we got 5 seconds. We can't do it for 5 more seconds. Yeah, we got to follow the rules here. We posted this at a certain time. So, all right, we can now open. Is it a work session or a public hearing we have on this?
Public hearing.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 855. Huh? Oh, that's the other one. Yeah, okay. 855. And. Janet, you want to tell us about the amendment, the Dash 3, which replaces the bill? Right here, Janet.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 3 amendments, which just came out of Legislative Council, would say that out of the allocation of highway funds that goes to the Department of Transportation, this is after allocation to cities and counties, the first $30 million would be allocated to counties that are affected by the loss of federal funding due to the expiration of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. If that law is not reauthorized by October 1st, 2007. And, Mr. Chair, the emergency clause would make this take effect immediately, and the allocation of funds could begin at the beginning of the biennium. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Actually, it would take effect October 1st. Colleagues, what this is a response to the ever-elastic moves in Washington, D.C. regarding the obligations of the federal government to our state and through our counties. And you're well aware of the of this issue. I think it's important that we provide some opportunity to keep from totally self-destructing in some of our counties. Senator Courtney and I and Susan, Representative Morgan, Representative Cruz and others were down touring for 2 days some of the states affected by some of the counties affected by this in rural Oregon and the southern part of the state. And it is extremely serious with the bulk of their funds for not only transportation but others have been dependent on this federal agreement. And we certainly cannot afford to totally, with the stress that we're already under, to totally turn all of our roads back to gravel right now while we're trying to figure this out. I think we're all very hopeful that the federal government is going to realize it has an obligation. This is not a handout. This was an exchange of property, an exchange for revenues that are no longer being allowed to come forth through timber harvesting, that there is an obligation of the federal government on that. We are hopeful that our partners in Congress are going to be able to provide some relief on this issue, to continue some payments, to provide some other avenues in which we can work with our county partners for a long-term solution to this. The reality is we may not know by the time we're out of session whether there has been a renewal or partial renewal. And so the reason that we have the October 1st trigger date is because we would not be in session. If, in fact, there is some stopgap funding that does go into law prior to October 1st, in whole or in part, this would not take effect. But at least it would trigger that if by the fact that we're ending this Congress and they have not met that obligation. This does not replace the money. It's only about a third of the money for transportation that our counties received. And it does come out of ODOT's basically existing balance. I think it would be money that would be appropriate spent, but we hope we don't have to do it. So that's the purpose of it. I'd like to ask Art Schlack and Doug Tindall to come forward on this issue. Mr. Schlack representing counties and Mr. Tindall representing the cash register where the money is.
Here's my wallet, Art. Thank you very much. Oh, can I have your visa tickets? Yeah, no. I'll keep
those. Athletic events.
Oh, yeah. So, Mr. Schlack, you signed up first, so I'll let you comment first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. The Association of Oregon Counties appreciates the efforts of the chair of this committee and other members of the legislature to recognize the situation counties are in with the possibility of 106-393 going away, the Secure Rural Schools Act. As you've heard probably already from me and others, counties will lose over $90 million a year to their road budgets, assuming that 106-393 is not reauthorized. This is a very elastic situation. We are continuing to work with the Oregon legislative delegation and others to try and get reauthorization. There are some days when it's more hopeful than others, and we will see what happens with the bills as they go forward to the president here in the next couple of weeks with different provisions in them to try and get some funds either in whole or part as we decline from this program. Mr. Chair, as I indicated, these efforts are greatly appreciated. It is truly an offer by the legislature to provide a bridge to help counties in part, and we greatly appreciate the effort here.
Okay, before we go to questions, I'll ask Mr. Tindall.
Thanks. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation. Joking aside from the little stunt coming up here, ODOT does appreciate the situation that the counties are in and understands the situation that puts the counties and the legislature in and facing a very difficult policy choice. Just to tell you the impact of the bill to us, the federal regulations require us to have a fiscally balanced statewide transportation improvement program. The 08-11 STIP is currently in draft form and out for public hearing, spends down all of the department's revenues by 2011. So with passage of this bill, we would move out $30 million worth of projects from the 08-11 STIP. But we understand, again, we understand and appreciate the situation of the counties and just needed to carry that impact to you.
Okay, thank you. First of all, just a comment. Colleagues, this bill goes to Ways and Means where it'll be considered in relation to the department's budget and all these other issues. there clearly is a disagreement, I think, between the department and legislative fiscal and those of us who have talked to legislative fiscal about the availability of these dollars. Fiscal believes that that these dollars are available, do not require negative impacts to the department. But I understand the case that the department will make, and I think that is a ways and means discussion, because I understand that the department is supportive of what we're all trying to do and build our transportation infrastructure, and I realize it's just the question regarding your funds and how you allocate those on the ledger sheet. But fiscal has a different approach to that and believes those funds are available. The second thing I would comment on is just with the STIP, and it also assumes existing revenues. It does not make any, because you cannot make any assumptions for additional revenues that this legislature may indeed make, as we intend to do, between now and the year 2011. So, and then the third issue is, even with those two, if they were found, Mr. Tindall, to be, as you have viewed those, there's also this huge discussion that the department has also reiterated that when it gets down to making tough choices in the short term, that maintenance and preservation is very important. And so it's also a policy choice that we don't want to lose the infrastructure we have, even if that meant some kind of temporary reduction. But I think it's an important for our counties, because we just don't know the status. We're all hopeful that this bill never gets triggered, because our federal partners can help restore those funds. So questions from the committee? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, if you could, as I understand, the department has any fund balances every year, and as I understood the original intent as I read this bill, these dollars would come out of the any fund balance and not affect the STIP. Can you explain to me how the department's interpreting this so it comes directly out of the STIP?
Chair Metzger, Representative, or I'm sorry, Senator George, I'll try. We have this is a not a simple equation. The department has adopted a policy, a philosophy of having a ending balance of $100 million, and we feel that that's the prudent thing to have in order to assure that we can pay off our debts to our contractors, which spike during the middle of the summer, without doing short-term borrowing. We do that because short-term borrowing is not a real good business decision, costs us a lot of money. So when I say that we're going to spend down our revenues by 2011 in the 08-11 STIP, what I'm saying is the balance that is above $100 million today, which there is some balance above $100 million today, is being programmed into projects that will be delivered in 08-11, so that at the end of the 08-11 STIP, you will end up with I call zero ending balance. The financial people and the financial sheets would show a $100 million ending balance. If you take this $30 million or any amount of money out of that ending balance, you can say that to us, well, Doug, that was interesting that you decided $100 million was right. We don't think it's right. It should be $70. And you can certainly do that, there is the potential of having some impact on our bond rating, because our bond rating is based partially, not totally, but partially on the fact that we have taken that step to retain that $100 million ending balance as a target balance, as we operating balance, to make sure that we can cover our debt. I hope this is incredibly complicated, complex. I hope I've been able to explain that.
Thank you. Makes sense.
Thank you. As Mr. Tindall knows, and talking with legislative fiscal, they carry an estimate, it's actually closer to $200 million, and there's issues there, but that is a ways and means discussion. I think policy, I think we're on the same table, that we want to all have a sound transportation infrastructure. This is an opportunity for the department to discuss the fiscal implications of this in ways and means. But I think from a policy standpoint, this committee, the legislature, supports our partners and wants to make sure that there are some opportunities here to maintain some semblance of a transportation program, because it affects all of us as we drive in and out of these counties. Any other questions? Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 855. Open a work session on Senate Bill 855 with the dash 3.
Mr. Chairman, the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 855.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 855. Any discussion? Any objection?
Sir. Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 855 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 855 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Objection. So ordered. All right. That discussion. So Deckard excused. Okay, now we can do 1045. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. Colleagues, this is a very brief bill. And this arises out of our discussion about having some accountability with enterprise zones, employers, job creation. The reason it's very short is because we're out of time. And there is a lot more work that's going to be done, so this basically is a placeholder so we can continue making amendments on the House of Representatives. Because of the way that works, we have no opportunity to continue that unless we have a vehicle to continue making amendments to it. So this one simply says that employers need to report to OECD their employment growth and its and how it relates to what we said they would do when they came into an enterprise zone. But there will be a lot more coming. That's just basically tells you what the intent is. So my goal would be just to pass this through the floor so that we can continue to elaborate on it. And that's all the public hearing we're going to have on this one. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1045.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 1025 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 1045 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So we're Mark Senator Deckard is excused, and we got through the agenda. We got one more day of Senate bills left. We are adjourned. Thank you all.